you don't need any further introduction. You've been here for the entire time period. Yeah. And your title is two?
Yeah, I... so Alexander was pestering me to put my title on the wiki, and he didn't see anything appearing, so I think you put it in yourself, but actually the title was there, but it was just empty. No, it's, basically what I've done for this talk is I've put a bunch of stuff from myself together in subjects that have been inspired by things that I've taken from the work program so far, which has been inspirational. So this is just my title. I don't have a better title for my talk today. So for those of you who weren't here when I first gave my talk, this is a video of a typical three-dimensional turbidity current experiment in our larger flume. So the camera is suspended underwater, and it's looking towards a feeding area, an inlet area, which is about 5 meters away from the camera. And the current is introduced, and it accelerates down a slope. And here, quite close to the camera, there are a bunch of velocity probes, which measure the velocity field as the current comes past. And my question basically is, if I find a turbidity current deposit in the field, this is one in Italy, which has been brought up by tectonic processes, so we can study it there in along the beach in Tuscany. So how is that flow process related to the deposits that I find? And I want to know that because if I do know it, then I will be able to predict how the deposit changes away from this location and vertically. And that's the kind of stuff that the petroleum industry is very interested in. Yeah.
I wasn't here for your talk.
Yeah.
And I don't know how wide the reference is, but it seems to be as it comes down that there's like a lagging middle.
Yes, there is, and that's because the initial slope was just flat, but this is not the first experiment performed on that slope. I think this is the second or third experiment, and one of the earlier experiments actually deposited a lobe in front of the outlet, and this later experiment actually starts to be diverged around that lobe and be split around it. So we're looking at how subsequent turbidity currents are shaping and building the seascape. Yeah.
What do you think the Reynolds number is here?
Tens of thousands. Yeah. Typically. Yeah. So we go from like 30 to 70, 80,000 Reynolds number. If I just use the flow depth as the scale.
What kind of scales are we talking about? Like flow depth, flow volume, and slope?
The slope here is we do experiments between 4 and 12 degrees. Discharges are typically 10 to 40, 50 cubic meters per hour. So that's some liters to ten liters per second. Flow depths are typically up to 10 centimeters. And depth average flow velocity is typically half a meter per second.
And they're released from behind a gate? The material is released from behind a gate?
No, it's from a pump. We don't do any lock exchange experiments. We all do in pump. We just have a big tank with a big mixer, which is designed to homogenize sand and water up to about 30% sand. And we just pump that into our experiment.
With laser height sensors.
Sorry?
Are they laser height sensors?
No, they are they're Doppler velocity probes. Yeah, so they send out ultrasound, these at 1 megahertz, and they send bursts of 1 megahertz sound out, and they listen for the Doppler shift in the return signal. And based on that, they calculate the velocity of the particles.
So
How, what's the diameter of the particle?
In this case, the D50, so the medium grain size is 160 microns. And then we typically stick to that, like 130 to 160 for the D50. And then going up to about 250 microns for the D90 and the coarse fractions. There is no silt in this experiment. We also do experiments mixing in silt and even clay, kaolinite, and that completely changes everything. But in these experiments, there's only sand. Okay, so one of the things that I notice about the structure of these currents when we look at them in experiments is that the front, which we call this first part the head of the current, it keeps blowing up and it actually engulfs the camera. And here, after that head passes, there's a draft downwards. And we can see that there's kind of a steady body coming down the slope. And if we look at a cross-section of a two-dimensional current, this is a video image, but it's not an image. It's actually got a time on the horizontal axis, so it's just taken a strip of the video in each frame, and it's put that next to each other, so we get like a time image of the current. And we find that this we have a very anthropomorphic terminology for this. We have a head, a neck, a body, and a tail. Well, it's not really anthropomorphic with a tail, but you get the point. So this is what geologists use as terminology for this. And there's this transition here in the neck between really high velocities in the body, the quasi-steady part of the flow, and everything that goes on in the frontal part here. So red is very high velocity and blue is zero velocity of the ambient fluid.
Is that a real aspect ratio? Well, what do you think the front angle is?
I don't know, because it's not the real aspect ratio, no.
Because it's time.
Yes, yeah. And I can't give you a good answer. Also because I'm presenting it here as a vertical profile, but the velocity probe is actually oriented at an angle to get that horizontal component. So we would have to look at the shape in subsequent images and compare those, and I haven't done that.
I'm still trying to understand what exactly we're looking at there in the middle frame. So you said on the horizontal axis is time, right?
Yes.
But why is the other axis inclined like this? Is this supposed to be a three-dimensional perspective?
No, this is it's two-dimensional, but it's an attempt to compare the visual structure of the flow to the velocity structure. But the problem is that the velocity probe is at an angle and the pixel line is vertical. So this is an attempt to find the correct transformation between the scales, which in this case wasn't successful, but it's as a visual indication, it still serves its purpose. But it's not a precise map of velocity onto the pixel values. I'm also not pursuing it because I'm not specifically interested.
So how is the imaging done in the middle one then? The bottom one's from the Doppler.
This is from the Doppler.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a 210 frames per second camera from which the middle pixel line is extracted each frame. And they're just sequentially.
And this is through the sidewall.
Yes.
And the Doppler's okay. Right.
Yeah. That's also this is the view from the sidewall. The Doppler velocimetry is actually somewhere in the middle of the.
Do you get backscatter from your Doppler?
Yes.
You kind of use as an indicator of concentration.
Yes, but I've never managed, and I.
Signals
No, because I'm not good enough in sonic signal processing.
Okay.
That's the honest answer. I've looked at it, The amplitude of the backscatter, and the people who sell this apparatus also say that it works for that. But I would need a postdoc to actually do that for me. I'm not going to do it myself. So that made me think of when Andrew Hogg presented his work on spreading of a plume, a volcanic ash plume in the atmosphere, and he talked about solutions linking the unsteady thick region of the front and the head through a shock with a steady radially expanding solution up there. I didn't put his next slide in, but his next slide shows that the unsteady region of the head keeps changing as the plume expands, but the main body of it remains in a similar steady thickness. And the reason why we have a continuous thickness here, there's a decreasing thickness here, is because that's a radially expanding plume, and we're looking at a two-dimensional plume. And this actually excites me a little bit, because a few years back we actually looked a little bit more carefully at that structure. So this is now the UVP probe is vertically buried in the bed, and the current goes over it. And again, I'm plotting this with time on the horizontal axis and elevation above the bed on the vertical axis. Blue meaning velocities going down, and red velocities going up. And we can see that in the front there are very strong velocities directed upwards. And then later in the back there of the head, there's actually a down draft. And in this region of the neck, if we zoom in on that data, we find this area of very intense turbulence here, somewhere midway in the flow. And after you look a lot at these pictures, you will actually start to pick up the structures. So there is an area of blue and dark yellow-red eddies, kind of about this elevation here, which is what we call the lower velocity maximum of the shear layer near the bed. Then we can see, if we're away from the neck a little bit, that there are generally more gentler colors here. And then here at the top, there's another area of very strong eddies, turbulent structures.
Do you think at the top that's the mixing layer?
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is a plot from a completely different experiment, but it turns out that this happens again and again. So we have turbulent kinetic energy of one velocity component, elevation above the bed. There is a lot of turbulence in the very thin shear layer near the bed. There is a lot less turbulence if we go up. This is slightly below the velocity maximum. The velocity maximum is actually here. So there is a displacement between the lowest gradient in velocity and the lowest intensity of the turbulence. And then if you go up again from that, we find the turbulence associated with the mixing layer. And that's this elevation here. But in the neck, what we actually see is that this typical structure is not applicable. We find these areas of incredibly intense turbulence. And if we zoom in even further, so these are seconds. So one block is one measurement collected over 11 microseconds. And we can see that there are areas here where the velocity changes are on the order of 0.1 meter per 11 milliseconds. 0.1 meter per second per 11 milliseconds. So that's not an acceleration of the fluid, but it's a gradient in velocity, which is, if you calculate it, about 9 meters per second squared. So very intense very, very intense velocity changes. And these values obtained here are on the order of 30 or 40% of the mean velocity, so they are not associated with a normal shear of the current. So so when we looked at that initially, we said, okay, so there's a rapid flow expansion. The flow becomes a lot thicker over that boundary. There's a rapid deceleration, and there's incredibly dramatic turbulence along that transition. And when we were searching for a word, we called it a breaking hydraulic surge. But Andy in his presentation called it the shock, linking the unsteady to the steady part of the flow. I think that offers a great way for further treatment of this. And the reason I'm really interested in it is it doesn't just do those things to the velocity field. It also has a very strong decrease of the bed shear stress between the body and the head. And the key thing here is that when the current passes, this area or this part of the structure passes a location first, and then the body comes after. But the velocity in the body is, in these situations, always higher than the displacement velocity of this part of the structure. So the fluid itself is actually going from the body into the front. So the fluid itself experiences a strong decrease in the bed shear stress when it goes from the body to the head. And our hypothesis a few years ago was that that it's this part of the structure that causes rapid suspension fallout and is responsible for these typical, completely structureless, entirely unsorted basal divisions of many turbidity current deposits. So something to pursue further there. Moving on from that, a typical other expression of turbidity current deposits is these centimeter thick stratifications, which have received all kinds of different terms and nomenclature by geologists, but have always been very poorly explained in terms of the processes that actually happen near the bed when these deposits are formed. And question put to me a while back was, do you think that the type of treatments of a kinetic or extended kinetic theory of dense layers near the base or UI rheologies are good descriptions that can be used to describe these basal high density layers in turbidity currents and also the eventual formation of those types of deposits? And my answer is undoubtedly yes. If we take into account via a reduced coefficient of restitution or the viscous expression for I in this theory, viscously modified expression for I, then I'm sure that's an excellent way forward to go. And actually, there's a paper that we have coming out at the moment. Cartini et al. It's in the present JSR, in which we look at experiments in which we subsequently increase the concentration further. And at the highest concentration, we observed that in the current, and this is another one of those time images, we observed interfaces between regions of different behavior of the current, where we have a dilute region with a lot of turbulence and a lot of mixing going on, and at the bottom we actually have an entirely homogeneous suspension without any fluid or lower density parts in it, with very small turbulence, always these velocity vectors that are relatively relatively horizontal. This was fairly qualitative at that time, not really linked to the quantification of the flow field, the velocity measurements. But we did link those different regimes, stacked density layers, in a slightly speculative way, but based on a review of the literature, to a frictional layer, a collisional layer, and a dilute region. And there's this geologists, when they talk about high density turbidity currents, have a transitional regime there. And I've noticed that in some other treatments, there can be a transitional regime here. That's all fine.
Do you see sharp interfaces then? Do you see always a gradual, smooth transition?
Yeah, you see a sharp interface, but then we said, okay, let's measure what happens over those that interface, for instance, in the velocity field or in the turbulence or in the concentration. And we can't really pick the interfaces out in those data types. So there's visually, there is really an area where there's a strong change in the behavior of the flow if you describe it. But if you want to pin it down in velocity or concentration or any type of measurement, it's really hard to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did you start these experiments? What was the initial stage?
Homogeneously mixed coming out of a pipe.
But with high concentration?
Yes. Well, high, we all have different descriptions of high. This particular experiment was 26% initial volume. But we, yeah.
And these are sand as well.
Yeah. And we
steadily depositing in this sort of more laminar region at the bottom.
We can have this structure both steadily depositing but also purely bypassing. So we can have that's the thing that I learned from this is that we can, if we increase the input concentration, we start to, so very low concentration, you just start off with a turbidity current that's this, and you increase the concentration, you go beyond a certain value, you start to get this developed, and then you go even further, you start to get that developed. But all those different structures, all of them can bypass, erode, and deposit their sediment.
I don't know what you mean by bypass.
The zero deposition and zero erosion as well. Yeah.
What's the nature of the bed?
It's glued sand with the same grain size. Sorry?
Cannot move.
No. But in the three-dimensional experiment I showed, we have a movable bed of the same sediment.
And the size distribution of the particles? Is it monodisperse or?
Well, it's not very broad. No, it's so. We're in these experiments. It's I think 160 again for the D50, and then the D90 is 250. So it's fairly well sorted.
That's because I was looking at the picture and I saw grains of different sizes.
No, this
in the sketch, sorry.
Yes. Yeah, that should not be interpreted. I know why it's there, but it's not in the experiments. This sounds really, really bad. It's not there. There's a geological observation that if we look at turbidity current deposits, there are often the largest grains and clasts are at the top of layers. And Mathieu has drawn them in here for an attempt in the discussion to talk about whether grain size segregation could be responsible for that. But we have no observation in the experiment to justify that.
And the frictional region, I suppose, is the region where you apply the mu-I rheology?
We haven't applied it, Whereas, it, I mean, the suggestion is that it would be worthwhile to try to apply it. But actually, my question in the coming few slides is whether it's going to work or not.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
The velocity distribution associated with the concentration distribution. Can you describe the velocity distribution?
In these particular experiments, we hadn't optimized the working of the velocity probe yet, which means that the resolution of the velocity in the experiment near the bed is not very good. I'm trying to think whether I have a plot of it in the, later in the presentation, but I don't.
At least where the concentration is linear, do you know whether the velocity is close to being logarithmic or linear as well?
It's not logarithmic.
Okay.
I can tell you that for sure, but I can't give you a good description of what it is.
Is this a schematic then, the velocity?
Yes, I mean that's why it's dotted. We do have later measurements where I can make a sketch because I think I threw the plot out. So if the logarithmic velocity will look like that. Up to the an area just beneath the velocity maximum, then if we actually start to deposit from these flows, the velocity will actually look like this. So there is actually a change of the direction of the curvature of the velocity profile.
So I wonder if this can be related to the mechanisms that Rama Govindarajan suggested. Remember, she was talking about the influence on the viscosity. And so if you have this strong stratification in terms of the particle concentration, it could mean that near the wall, the viscosity is significantly higher. So you have a lower velocity gradient, and then the velocity increases as the concentration goes down.
I think that's the one good suggestion, and I think the other one is that the stratification itself, and I think Tom Su, when he was here, discussed the balance between those two. So he suppressed turbulence at the base of his simulations, and he had two explanations, either the changing the rheology and the effect of viscosity, or actually changing the stratification, so actually stabilizing the stratification of the base of the flow. And he thought both could be explained different stabilizations in different cases, and I'm not sure what would be the most correct way to for us.
Sorry, back to the nature of the bed.
Yeah.
You said the same grains that you have in the flow, they were glued at the
bed,
or different grains?
The same grains.
The same grains, and glued randomly, I think.
Yes.
So that might be due to the dissipative nature of the boundaries, because close to the boundary you are subtracting energy from the flow.
But this is
why you have this inflection point.
Yeah, the inflection point arises when we start to deposit the bed. So at that point, the bed is actually a mobile bed.
But it's more dissipative.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Did you also say that you did the experiments where you had multiple bleed flow?
Yes. I haven't analyzed the data with that question in mind. But it's something, I mean, it would be fairly straightforward to set up an experiment in which we manipulate the discharge such that it will deposit first, and then we increase the discharge, and it will actually start to go into a bypassing current and then start to erode. And that will be the experiment to test whether it is the nature of the bed. And it's something that I've told a few students of mine that it would be worthwhile testing, but they haven't done it yet.
Changing slowly.
Yes. Yeah, not too fast.
Not too fast.
No. But we have a few minutes in these experiments typically to play around with, so we can do it slowly.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be my... I think in an experiment that was a failure from some perspective in which the discharge was not constant, I think I've seen that. And I think that when it starts to erode again, it reverts to a logarithmic, but I'm not sure. I can't tell you.
Really?
Yeah.
But what kind of initial concentrations do you need in order to only get the dilute? Or the dilute and the collisional?
9% by volume. Yeah, and I mentioned that number because it's, I think Bucknell proposed that thinking, but it's kind of that region. Some people say 8, others 12. Yeah, it's
presumably it depends on the slope angle. Because if you've got a very slope angle, it's all going to be suspended.
Yes, but with a different concentration at the base. So if you have because I mean there the problem with these experiments is that if you change the that initially the discharge was kept constant, so if you increase the concentration you increase the mass flux into the experiment. Therefore if you change the concentration, you change two parameters in one time. So I think they need to be isolated before that question can be answered. So something that I've been wondering whether it's important or not, which is the pore fluid and how it behaves, especially in non-steady situations with a changing boundary. So before we go there, I thought I'd have a little geohazard break because that always is a success. So this is an incredibly dramatic event, and what this is, it's the 2011 earthquake, one of the largest on record, and this is the GPS, the real-time GPS data during just after the earthquake. So that is actually the displacement of Japan during the earthquake, and the scale here is that this is a 1 meter arrow. And these are the stations on the coast just next to the earthquake actually have an arrow that goes off into the next plot. So I think the...
So it means that at that moment the horizontal displacement is about
10 meters. 10 of the coastline. Huh? Mm-hmm. And the vertical, so that's half a meter vertical. The coastline here goes down a few meters. So that's incredibly dramatic. The next one this has a slightly lower resolution, but it's got all the data of all of Japan in it. And what you can actually see on this plot is you can see the waves of the earthquake propagating across Japan. So this is probably the Japan and also the western part of the United States have the best monitoring of the displacement of the Earth systems that there are, and it's not a.
Does it go back to its original shape?
No. But the point is, of course, that Japan is slowly creeping that way. Because the plate of the ocean is coming this way and it's crushing up against it, and so it's pushing Japan towards the west for 50 years or 100 years, and then the fault decides to slip, and then the whole of Japan comes over the ocean in one go. And it displacement at the coast there is 10 meters, but people actually use that GPS data and they put in the oceanography and they made a spatial model of the fault plane, which is this triangulated mesh, and they used the GPS data to as a boundary condition to match the slip on that fault plane in a dynamic simulation of the earthquake. And the displacement of the fault at the core is actually going towards 40 meters. So that's an earthquake, a really big earthquake is a really big fault over hundreds of kilometers, really slipping for tens of meters. High drama. And this is the geophysics and geodetics people doing doing this work. So where does the sedimentology of these events?
Which is slipping where? I mean,
okay. So I'm used to talking to people who know the signs in these graphs, so I may not be. So I'll try to go through it, and if it's not clear, then interrupt.
Is the plate to the right plunging under?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a trench here, which is very, very deep. So the plate from the right is coming like this, and these arrows mean that the fault plane between the two plates is dipping in that direction, and this plate is actually going underneath there. And Japan is coming over the top like that. And this plate is continually moving, and this whole thing gets squashed. That's all stored as elastic energy. And if there is an earthquake, all of that gets released and the whole thing relaxes and shoots off.
So what has happened? Is it that kind of a?
It's a, really a disc.
The top plane is skipped over.
Yes,
the bottom
in
plane?
In a discontinuity.
Yeah.
And that happens in. It's what's called the co-seismic slip. So that's the slip taking place during the earthquake over that surface is 40 meters.
Is this vertical or horizontal?
This is horizontal. It's probably a true displacement along the plane that is dipping like this in the, into the subsurface. Yeah.
But is that plane dipping or is that?
It is. Yeah.
So they're both dipping.
Yeah. The plane in this case is the boundary, basically the boundary between the two plates. So if I would draw it on here, in cross section. So we have an ocean with Japan, and then a coast like that. Then there's a very deep trench. And there's an oceanic plate, which moves under Japan. And this is where the big earthquakes happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in between earthquakes, everything is elastically compressed, and an earthquake relaxes all of that. And that's ocean subduction, basically.
If you go back one slide to the stuff that Chris said, the wave propagation, this is going back and forth, is kind of not staying the same shape.
No, the wave is a wave, yeah. So boof. So that's the wave, but this is the situation at the end after the waves have propagated away, and it has Japan is displaced towards the east. So the waves are a fluctuation around that displacement, and at the end there is a final displacement of Japan after the earthquake.
In this figure,
yeah.
Not in the next figure.
This.
I don't understand why the largest displacement didn't take place at the edge of the plate.
My sense is that.
Yeah, the earthquake is.
Senses on land.
No.
Yeah.
No. The earthquakes have a. There are there is a patchwork. Obviously, the entire plate margin needs to move, and it does so by a patchwork of earthquakes. And this is the depth and the location at which the really big earthquakes happen. But if you look at a seismic map of Japan, or for that matter of California, you will see California has registered earthquakes a few every day. I mean, even here, but we don't feel them because they're small. And it's that patchwork of all the earthquakes combined that if you would add all those displacements, you actually get a homogeneous displacement. Okay. But a really big earthquake typically happens in a location and a depth that is there.
Is it two-dimensional model?
I think it's three-dimensional, but I wouldn't know because I don't know these people and it's not my specialty. So don't mistake me for a geophysicist because these people are very very advanced. This is where I come in. So where is what's the sedimentology associated with those events that litter the geological history? The first one is, of course, the one that grabbed all the attention when it happened because it was incredibly catastrophic and involved massive loss of life. But I'm not going to talk about that or show any videos of it. The second one is that people talk about turbidity currents generated by earthquakes. So I didn't know or think whether there was a turbidity current associated with this one, but yesterday I checked on the internet and I found that a paper has come out online on geology whilst I was here, actually, that presents the evidence, which is quite convincing, that a turbidity current actually was triggered in this event. And they argue, and I think they're probably right, is that the tsunami triggered by the earthquake, when it traveled onto the margin, resuspended the sediment, and that actually flowed as a turbidity current down. They know this not because they were monitoring for turbidity currents, but in the picture on the top, that's an observational machine, which is probably about this big, which is meant to measure the pressure in the water and the temperature and things like that. So it's an oceanographic monitoring station, and it recorded the main earthquake in the pressure signal. And then after about 3 hours later, the pressure actually starts to increase until 15 minutes later it stabilizes again. So how should we interpret that as a turbidity current? The location of this device where they found it back, we can see it's been toppled, but it's also been transported for 1 kilometer. And it's been transported down slope, and it has gone down 14 meters between where they found it and where they had originally deployed it. And the units here are, I had to think about it for a while, but this is in 100,000 hectopascals, so we can read it as bars. So this is just one atmosphere. And we can see the pressure rise is about 1.4 of those units. So it was transported by the current. Also, there's a temperature anomaly, which is a little bit less easy to interpret, but the idea is that the pore fluid in the turbidity current comes from a different depth as the local temperature. And this data they used to come up with some estimates of velocity. The easiest one is the time delay between the earthquake and the tsunami and when the observatory started moving, which gives about a 2.4 to 7.1 meters per second, depending on when you think the tsunami generated the current. They also put some flow thickness and concentration measurements into some simple parameterizations. And those shouldn't really be read as a velocity estimate of 8 meters per second, but more of a like which parameters coexist in turbidity currents. So if we would have a 20 meter current with 9% concentration, it would be traveling at approximately 8 meters per second, which makes sense with the time delay. And thirdly, they said, okay, if this were a boulder, then can we put a drag coefficient on it and think about thresholds of movement? And they estimated that if you do that, then you need a turbidity current of 2.8 meters per second to start moving it. So that's conveniently near the lower end of the estimate. So that's all fairly consistent, and it's within the range of values that we're starting to be very happy with for these sorts of events. So what I'm really hoping for is somebody who's going to actually measure the basal velocity and density structure of these currents one day, and not just keep doing these indirect guesstimates from accidents. Perhaps one day. But the third importance of turbidity of these types of things for sedimentology. This is. See if the sound works. Oh, it's a different earthquake. This is in Tokyo.
Earthquake right now.
This is after the earthquake. Look at that. So the whole ground of the park is doing this, and
my plant is not there.
So that's not the movement of the earthquake, because that goes at 4 kilometers per second. This is actually after the earthquake. And
let's see, different parts, like a through. Wow, there's water just coming up like that.
See, and that's the point, there's water coming up. I'll leave it to run, because there are some nice parts in it.
Ground is just staying right now.
Do you say this was after the earthquake?
Yes. How long
after the earthquake?
Just to look how it goes out in the... This will be a few minutes after it. You can see that the whole thing is just kind of... And now you can start seeing water coming out through the cracks. And they're actually... They are making these fountains periodically when the...
Different places. Here's coming up to the sidewalk.
Wow.
The buildings were making a racket.
And this is this is really weird.
I seriously thought I was sick first, because I didn't know what's going on.
It feels like a disaster movie.
Yes. And the guy is so composed in his sculpture. Look, that's the really nice. Here you can see that when the shoals converge, they actually spout up this fountain of mud. Here, look at how it makes these fountains in the...
Especially since this is reclaimed land.
There we are.
This used to be part of Tokyo Bay.
There.
And they created this land by throwing landfill and mountains, rocks out here. And so this land could just...
So that's the key point, that it was actually Tokyo Bay, and it's a landfill. And when the earthquake hits that area, the grains actually compact, they reorganize. So the packing of this that they have made was not the maximum packing. The earthquake can have ground accelerations this far away in Tokyo, probably like 0.2 or 0.3 G, I estimate. So very high ground accelerations, and they reorganize the grains, and it's saturated with pore fluid, and all of the weight is actually transferred onto the pore fluid. And that's why the the bark, the upper part, which is not saturated, just starts to kind of float around on what's underneath. Mm-hmm. And that starts to actually eject through those cracks.
It's also an issue for buildings that have been built.
Yes, yeah. What happens a lot is that you see these pictures. If you go on the internet and you search for liquefaction earthquake, you get all these pictures of flat buildings that have just toppled over without breaking up. They've just kind of gone down into the ground.
Is that what happens in Mexico City all the time, DRS?
I think so, yeah, but I have no...
Similar, but it's a little lake bed.
Yeah, and it also, the earthquake in Christchurch in 2001, which disrupted, apparently New Zealand is like a small town community, so it entirely disrupted it because there was a lot of damage, but a lot of people actually got hurt for such a small country. And the reason, this is not a really big earthquake, but the reason that there was a lot of trouble is the same.
Now, seismologists claim that much of the damage that's been caused across Christchurch has been caused by a phenomenon called liquefaction. A couple of days ago, we had never heard of that term, but everyone speaks about liquefaction, and indeed, you can see it everywhere around you, because this quake was a relatively shallow, just 5 kilometres below sea level. And what it's meant really is that a lot of that soil has turned to mud. Raquel Everly has the details on this story.
In just mud.
Oh, it's not.
This moments, isn't where words turn.
Yeah. Oh. So this family was actually riding in that car during the earthquake. So you ride over a road.
Nightmare.
And the earthquake hits, and they actually, and the car just started to go down, and all of them came out, and they made this picture. And I think that the cars on the roads didn't make any victims, so I feel okay showing this picture. This is not where the victims were from, but it does illustrate the process. So you have a road which has a strength because a car can drive over it, but if the earthquake hits and the road is almost saturated, then the reorganizations of the grains actually means that you need to get rid of the pore fluid. And that's what I wanted to end up talking about. So the reorganization of the grains, the compaction means that you need to dissipate the pore fluid. And because that doesn't happen instantaneously, the pore fluid pressure is very high. And the pore fluid pressure gradient actually starts to support the weight of the sediment grains.
So this was the February earthquake, not the September earthquake, is that correct? There was one in September where actually nobody was killed, and then there was another one the next February.
It was not
as strong formally according to the scale.
Yeah, but resulted in,
people
yeah. I can't give you the answer for sure, but I think that's absolutely correct. Yeah, because this is the key thing here is the soil was right to do a lot of damage in this earthquake. So it was a surprise that there was so much damage and so many victims. But I should have checked that. I can't give you the answer for sure.
That's a very effective runaway run.
So earthquakes are very spectacular doing that, but in sedimentology, liquefaction is not something associated with large earthquakes at all. It happens all the time. And this is an experiment in sedimentology in 2006. So what they have done is they prepared a bed with silt to a coarse silt to very fine grained sand, D50. And they, after they prepare it, so they prepare it by spreading the sediment under water in the flume, but they don't compact it. And the porosity is 0.58 when they do that. And then they start running waves over the top, and they monitor the pore pressure over four stations in the vertical cross section.
Because it's in water.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's saturated with water. The axis confused me a little bit at first. The eta divided by 8, that is scaling of the water surface elevation of the waves. So they are co-plotting the wave elevation, which is this trace here, typical wave profile for shallow water waves with a sharp crest and a broad valley in between. That's the eta divided by 8 scale on the axis. And then the other one is pressure divided by gamma, which is the pressure which they have manipulated in such a way that this axis shows a centimeter of pressure equivalent to the weight of the sediment. Okay, so when they start the experiment, the pressure throughout the entire depth is simply that of the water above it. So there is no elevated pore pressure. So they just have that as zero, though it increases.
It's the hydrostatic value.
That's hydrostatic, yeah. And then when they start to run the waves, the pressure, pore pressure starts to diverge from that, and it converges to a new value, which I and a lot of people often call the lithostatic pressure. Which is basically the pressure, if you take the entire column of sediment and water above it. So in all of our transport problems so far, what we have called the hydrostatic pressure in the flow that transports sediment is what we call the lithostatic pressure in this problem. And the hydrostatic pressure is really that it's the pressure in the pore fluid when nothing is moving and all the sediment grains are grain supported. So we can see that the pressure in the pore fluid is actually a lot higher than that, but also there is a strong pressure gradient. So this is at 17 centimeters depth, 12.5 centimeters depth, 7.5, 5.5. And that gradient in pressure is approximately equal to the vertical thickness of the increasing weight of the sediment as you go down into the substrate.
These pressure measurements are different heights in the bed.
Yeah. So these are 17 centimeters beneath the bed, 12.5 centimeters beneath the bed, 7.5 and 5.5 centimeters beneath
and
the bed.
And so all the material stays supported, it doesn't then decay and compact over time.
Yeah, it does. So this is the first, when they start the waves, it does that immediately. And then when they wait, this is how over 20 minutes,
relax,
that pressure relaxes and dissipates.
The waves are still going by.
Yeah, all the time. And actually, here in this phase, you actually generate wave ripples. So okay. Once the bed has completely relaxed, then you generate wave ripples here. But that takes almost 20 minutes. So so I put a bunch of stuff there so that I could remember myself if I got confused what actually the sequence of events and the processes are. So you turn on the waves, you start to change the packing because it's only 0.58, and when they sample it here, it's 0.64. So we go from 0.58 to 0.64. The pore fluid pressure state transposes from the hydrostatic pressure with depth to something that actually supports the grains above it, which is much higher. This actually means that the effective normal stress on the grain contacts approaches zero. And it means that there is no frictional resistance on those grain contacts. That's my, and I think the accepted process interpretation of what goes on here. So there is no frictional resistance to movement along the grain contacts. And it turns out that the grains will slip at negligible stresses. And this bed will actually start to generate internal waves with a small phase lag to the surface. Water wave elevation.
it might be worthwhile to mention for those of us who are here that this is more or less the opposite of the mechanism that Dave Morick talked about.
Yes. So Dave Morick talked about, so this is the compactional case when we go from higher porosities to lower porosities and actually set the bed. And what Dave Morick did, he actually set the bed in an experiment. So he went to 0.64 and then he took the vertical wall away from it, also underwater and completely saturated. And instead of that pile of grains just sagging away, the face of the sand actually needs to dilate. So taking the grains away means you need to dilate and you need an influx of pore fluid. And because of the time scales and the delay associated with that are so significant in water, you actually get you maintain a vertical wall which gently migrates away, and it's limited by the permeability of the pore fluid of the water into the wall. So it's those types of pore fluid migration that are set up by these things that are incredibly important. And I was wondering,
what's the hydraulic conductivity of the bed here?
I can't tell you, but it's the grain size is 60 microns, so it's very small. So it's low. Yeah, but it's. I will show you. Is that the next slide? No, it's not. Okay, so this also happens with smaller waves without liquefaction, but it's less dramatic and it takes less time. It also happens in coarser sand, so with a lot higher... I don't know any hydraulic conductivity values.
The other side is the same.
Yeah, but it happens in coarser sand as well. This is... So is this important for the geological record? It's incredibly important. You see it all the time. So this is one really nice dramatic instance from the far north of Scandinavia. Really old rocks. These are dune deposits in a river. The paleo-horizontal is the base of the pictures. So the inclination is actually the sedimentary structure inclination as the dune migrated to the right. But then at the top, we can see that the entire structure is completely disrupted and the whole thing just sheared top to the right.
Where's the lee face on this thing? You were saying that it's a dune migrating, where is that?
Yeah, this is the foreset.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is the it curves into the bottom set there. That's it's probably, I don't know what it is. Yeah, it's a pen, yeah. Sometimes it's very difficult. It is a pen, yeah. So that's the bottom 10 centimeters or so of the, this one is slightly bigger. I'm not sure what this is. It's not a pen, but this is a slightly bigger example. So the process interpretation that these authors have suggested, which is probably right, is this is not an earthquake effect, because this happens every 50 meters or so with one of these dunes. So some river systems are actually prone to these collapsing dunes. And their suggestion is that this happens when the flow field over the front of the top, so this is all fairly poorly compacted, 0.58, 0.59 material, and when the flow field here sets up some sort of vibration or disturbs the dune or whatever, it sets up this compaction and subsequent liquefaction effect, and the whole dune collapses, and you end up with these a picture of the part of the sketch which we've seen in the last slide, and then the dune sets itself up again and it migrates over the top. It's fairly convincing field evidence.
In the experiment you showed before, what was the new thing there? looked to me like this is stuff that has been known in geotechnics for a long time.
Absolutely, yeah. So there wasn't, it wasn't very new. It was just that it never, I think it got published because it was never in sedimentology before. But that can also be a worthwhile thing. It was an exposure to sedimentologists of how a poorly compacted bed will develop under waves. But liquefaction under waves is a very common topic in adjoining disciplines. You're right. So if we look at turbidity current deposits, when you see these types of things all the time. So this is a deposit of a laminated division here at the top, which was deposited onto a division which had not dissipated all its pore fluid yet. So whilst deposition of this sandy division went on, it just kind of sagged down into that mobile substrate. And you see these sorts of things also all the time, which are not really describable by common sedimentary structures caused by bed forms. They are associated with deformation of the substrate as the sand was being deposited. And this kind of periodic truncation and onset of deposition and truncation and onset of deposition again. And a structural geologist who looks at this will say that we can see that the deformation of the lower laminations, which we can see as timelines, is most intense. And the deformation actually decreases when we approach the top. And that's a signature of steady deformation that took place during steady deposition. So it's a growth structure. So the bed is actually being sheared. Oh, yeah. And in all these cases, if you... the sense of shear is consistent with the flow direction of the turbidity current. This is a really nice one. So two sandy divisions being deposited on top of each other, and we see these incorporations of the ductally deforming continuum of the lower division into the upper division. It's all mobile substrate examples. This is also quite a nice one. This is only 2 centimeters, 2 centimeters across.
It looks like an instability.
It does look like an instability.
It's a full common
one. Yeah. So all indications of in these deposits, in these types of events, the importance of that dissipation of that pore fluid. So we go from suspension deposition is, I mean, this is how I interpret it, and if anybody wants to comment, that's fine, but I interpret it such that it, the common occurrence of this indicates that if we deposit from suspension, then we don't go from the suspended concentration to the maximum packing concentration. But you go to this typical, like 0.58, perhaps a little bit more, a little bit less. And you need to get rid of those extra 5, 6, 7% of pore fluid. And that often happens during the deposition. But that dissipation has a certain time scale associated with it. And in this experiment, with the grain size of 60 microns, the dissipation front velocity, so they monitored with a video the movement of the substrate and when it stopped moving, and they plotted that along time, how that interface went up through the experiment. And that dissipation front velocity moved at about 3 times the grain size per second. So my suggestion is that if we are actually depositing from suspension and we are kind of in that range, then what we have is a substrate which is expulsing all this pore fluid. So one thing is it's deforming, and it generates these spectacular sedimentary structures. But I mean, you could perhaps get away with calling that the creep and just say, well, that's a very small movement. Yeah.
But isn't it true that these are tremendously deformable as long as the pore fluid is elevated?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't.
Very liquid.
Yeah, and I don't. I think that they're. I think that even calling something the bed during that deposition is entirely inappropriate.
I agree.
It's
a
flow.
Yeah.
Like a debris flow.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you have on the debris flow.
So then my question is, can we? If I have deposition like this, then can I still use those type of shear rate dependent frictional approximations like mu of I? Can I still use that? Because I know that the friction along the grain context here is actually.
The question is, what do you use for the pressure?
Yeah. Okay.
So you'd have to use a pressure adjusted for the elevated pore pressure.
So that, so this a bunch of questions that I put on here. So I can use, so the pressure needs to be reduced.
I think the answer to your, that's elevated pore fluid pressure equal reduced particle pressure, yes.
Okay. Well, good.
So if the particle pressure goes to zero, then the friction can stay the same, it has no effect.
So we can still use those formulations, but we need to know what the pore fluid pressure is, or the pore fluid pressure gradient.
The particle pressure, which is the, the complementary.
So does that mean that the that those approaches are in exactly the same way applicable to the problem of deposition from these high density suspension?
What do you mean? Are you trying to describe deposition? I mean, is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Describe deposition.
That's what I'm after, and my question is whether I can use those theories to describe the processes of the deformation in the same way, as in a steady solution.
Be correct about it. I would say yes. The rheology, you can describe the rheology of the bed, which in fact is a flow, in that way, and then the deposition is contributing to the pressure that is being experienced by that flow.
So the trick is that, for instance, in mu of I, you divide by the pressure, is that right? Yeah.
And that's the particle-particle pressure.
Right.
And that's going to be modified by the fact that the fluid pressure is elevated and relaxed.
So do we need to incorporate in the unsteady case then do we need to account for the migration of the pore fluid in there, which we don't need to do for a steady solution.
You need that's critical, and it's really the divergence of that, which is when it's being expelled, the particle pressure goes down, and when it's being sucked in, the particle pressure goes up.
Yeah.
Which is due to the drag force.
To the drag force?
Yeah, that comes
from the drag force on the particles. That's where the pore fluid excess comes from.
That's where the pore fluid what?
The pore fluid pressure excess comes from.
I'm not sure that I agree with that. Because the grains can be static and it still has a zero strength.
Because the fluid is being slowly squeezed.
No, you can contain the pore fluid and you contain the pore fluid gradient.
If you waited for some time in that situation, the grains would settle down there and then the pore fluid pressure would go to zero. There's a very, very small movement, which is what's supporting them. And at some point it will stop and the pore pressure will go back to hydrostatic.
So is there an expression for that drag? Do you have an expression for it?
Yeah. I mean, there are various models.
Okay.
I think you can also try to, if you have higher densities than or small particles, then the permeability will become very small. And then the time scale for the equilibration of the pore fluid pressure
becomes much longer. Yeah.
And I think that is a pretty short function of concentration and particle size. So depending on in which regime you are, you might want to try different formulations, because in one extreme it is the drag force, and in the other extreme it's, it can describe it very nicely with a diffusion equation. I mean, like the geotechnical people have done it for 70 years or so.
you just have to solve Darcy's law for the pore fluid, so that also gives you a time scale that scales as the square of the linear
distance. I can see that you need to formulate a Darcy problem for the pore fluid, so has anybody done that?
We've tried doing that for deadly flows.
Right. And so you've incorporated the Darcy flow for the dilation and the compaction of the... Okay. Well, that's great.
And we get these pressure measurements, four deadly flow measurements in the field.
Yeah. And they are consistent with that Darcy law?
There's only a couple of data sets. It's very rare that everything works.
I'd really like to see those. Is it published yet?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Well, we've done it also in the shallow water approximation.
Sorry?
We've done it in the shallow water approximation, so using depth average equations. We have incorporated the drag force and calculating the excess of pore pressure for the debris process.
Good.
2009, Jim, I think.
Well, that all goes towards solving my problems. That's good. Yeah?
You may also have the influence of pore pressure without any drag. Like And the way to solve the classical scheme is to use the BO equations for the solution of this problem. Of this problem where you have two phases, you have the rigid skeleton, which is deformable. The single particle is deformable, but more the solid skeleton. And so you have to give a geomechanical characterization of these, and then the fluid, which is also compressible. So all of that is considered in the BO equations.
Which equations the?
BO.
BO.
BIO.
I hadn't heard of that before. Yeah. So you were saying that I did get the first part where you said you can have those situations of pore pressure without having a drag. Coefficient.
I don't understand that.
That's why I was surprised what you said, because
consider this situation. We have a piece of soil with a layer of water above.
Yeah.
You double the layer of water.
Yeah.
So double the, and then you measure the wave pressure, the pore pressure in the soil. So it changes with time, also without any drag almost.
But there is a small movement of the particles.
It's very small, but it's very small.
It's associated with a large drag, because the drag coefficient depends on the concentration.
I mean, I can see that you can calculate, if you can say, I'm going to assume a drag and I'm going to calculate what it is based on, but can you also a priori say the drag coefficient of a grain needs to be the same as that in a dilute case?
No, it's different, because there is a concentration dependence.
Yeah. And in which way is there?
With Richardson and Zaki, I mean, there are various formulations.
Yeah.
And it diverges close to the...
But Richardson and Zaki is one of those things like, I've always thought that that's a highly empirical way of saying, well, let's just compensate for the concentration by doing that. Is that unfair of me? Because that, I'm not sure that that's a solution which is based on a physical insight of what the process is.
It can be calculated, this. Yeah. The whole theory of homogenization, where you're trying to calculate the diffusivity of these packings, but it can only be done for regular periodic packings. So when you want to go to realistic particles, you then can take some empirical law, and I'm sure that's the best that can be done.
But
in very idealized situations,
then it is the appropriate. Okay. You know, I was also thinking that you could have those situations without actually thinking about. With the grains just being a static grain-to-grain contact, and there being no real perceptible movement of the pore fluid, and if there is no perceptible movement of the pore fluid...
An non-hydrostatic pressure can be there because of vertical acceleration, so because there is a vertical inertia.
Yeah, but there's the vertical acceleration...
Or because there is drag force.
There has to be some resources. It diverges. You know, you've got an infinitesimal displacement multiplied by a very, very large quantity. Right. So it's a bit, you know, it's a very stiff problem.
It may help also to compare them. I recall the experiments that my colleagues at the University of Oslo around Anders Engelhoy did, and that was with debris flows. So these flows contained a lot of, not a lot, but some clay, and so the permeability was much lower. Mm-hmm. And they measured the pore pressure, and one could see that the flow is happening at a much shorter time scale than the time scale of the bed equilibrating.
Yeah.
So you are in one extreme, and the geotechnical people tend to be in the other extreme. And the problem is to how to bridge between.
Which extreme am I in? What can you do?
The permeability in your case is relatively high.
Relatively high, yes, but still low enough to. If we look at typical rates of deposition, so we have fluctuating deposition all the time over a few seconds, and the rate of deposition quantified from the experiments, and I've used D50 here just to make a non-official quantitative comparison with the liquefaction experiments, is in the same range as those types of dissipation front velocities. So you say the permeability is fairly high, but I will say that if you want to talk about deposition from these types of currents, you still need to incorporate a Darcy-type law for what happens with the base. Yeah. So you can't, I don't think you can ignore that. I think it always needs to be in there.
No, I mean, you're certainly not in a situation where it is instantaneous.
No, that's the point. It's not instantaneous. You need to account for the relaxation scales in the pore fluid.
At the extreme, there is in much extreme
cases. Yeah.
But the debris flow problems are then really on the extreme, because the flows there take a few seconds, and the equilibration time is of the order of 100 times.
Yeah, and I tend to get an idea that in our problem the two time scales are of equivalent order. So they're in the same range, yeah.
These are typically the hardest problems.
Good. I think we should probably start with stop with that. Yeah. Oh no, let's stop with another video. So here's a video of with a dual substrate where my student did one experiment the day before with only sand, which when we did this experiment was Fimex. And then this morning he did another experiment with a substrate which has a concentration Fimex minus some small epsilon, let's say 4%. And it has a little bit of silt in it as well, because that was the experiment. And we can see that, Peter already remarked this when I showed it the first time. I mean, that's just entirely dominates the question of erosion of this substrate. It's entirely determined by the precise state of the substrate and the pore fluid in it. And that
velocity,
it's an artifact that it doesn't go to zero in the bed. It's an approximate map of the velocity onto the video image. So this actually remains at zero velocity, and this bit here just gets completely swiped away because it hasn't settled.
That's underconsolidated.
Yes. Yeah. That will be one of those 0.58 beds. Yeah. And this must be incredibly important for modeling how the mass of these events evolves as they go down the slope. So we'll stop with that.
I think we kind of have moved automatically from your talk into question and discussion.
Yeah,
session.
We did.
But maybe other more questions? Or? No? All right, good. Well, thanks very much again. Those were some fantastic videos. Is there a chance you could provide the links to those videos or something like that? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all.
I mean, both the videos of your experiments, but also the videos of these earthquake things.
Yeah, sure.
It's all different.
Yeah.
What about the possibility of a European consortium focused on this kind of activity involving representatives from this group? And it seems to me it might be an important enough problem. We've got people coming from various areas of expertise that are interested in it. Does that make sense, or is that too much trouble?
It does make sense, but it's just worth thinking about how to organize it without it being too much trouble.
Yeah, but I see, let's say, representatives from a number of European countries here, and that seems to be a necessary ingredient in any European proposal.
Yeah, so I guess it all depends on what Brussels is in one of these, like the government shut down here a while ago. Brussels is currently negotiating the next framework program budget, which starts on January 1st. And the number is, both the content of the program and the number is fluctuating dramatically in the moment. But it's, I'm sure that things like those types of consortium things are going to be in there.
And here's a problem with, let's say, interesting to naturalists and also to industry.
Yeah.
So you're thinking in terms of securing funding? For that?
Yes. The European proposal, the EU, mm-hmm. which are notoriously difficult to write.
Yeah.
But
to administer.
Yeah, well, the problem is that basically, in a sense, it is very late now.
Now
the full negotiation and preparation for the calls for proposals that was at an earlier stage. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, if your topic is not in this in the bundle of topics, then you are out of luck.
So the request is made by topic, or?
Well,
I mean, I'm naive.
I mean, these things work best if somebody like you or Eckert would have been lobbying it for it in Brussels. You still have a chance, but I'm certainly not going to be able to. I can only write a project proposal for one of the other ones. But it's, I mean, it can be done. Yeah. Just needs somebody with a lot of credibility to do it. I think it. For the next one, is still wide open. You should have been lobbying for it. But
in theory, this next one is supposed to be less narrowly specified.
Yeah.
The previous one was like paragraph by paragraph. If you didn't have your paragraph in there, you couldn't get the funding.
I see.
And this one is supposed to be more wider. But
Actually, we had a program on this, project on snow avalanches that Jim was involved in also. And we were asked even to give input to the next round for the next program, and none of it was taken away. We made a very strong statement there about the needs, and nothing was taken in.
Well, I think if you manage to frame it in mass entrainment by and in relation to geohazards, then you may actually have a
There is an EU project at the moment working on debris flows, but unfortunately most of the people doing it don't really know anything about debris flows, so it's not clear how they got them on it.
Yeah, that's something you're thinking about then, it's a good suggestion.